And then at the beginning of chapter 8, when he opened the seventh seal, so chapter 8 continues the opening of the seals. All right, does everybody see that now? You know, get that fixed in your mind. The opening of the seals begins in 6. And we see it continuing in 6 and 7. And when it opens in 8, it's sort of like, have you ever noticed, have you ever seen these nesting boxes? When you open a box and you look inside the box, there's another box. And it appears to me that when this last seal, the seventh seal, is opened in chapter 8, it introduces a whole vision. And this vision is the seven trumpets. And so these seven trumpets then are blown and things happen in chapters 8, 9, 10, and 11. And then when we get to 12, we're going to see there's a kind of a startling difference. It is obvious as you just read along. It is obvious when you finish reading 11 and you start in 12 that you've come to a new section. So we're going to just concentrate now on the part that is before 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. And tonight we'll just primarily look at 6. But I want to advocate the idea, I want to present the idea that instead of every one of these sections, like 6, 7, and then the opening of the seventh seal at the beginning of chapter 8, and then the seven trumpets, and then 12 through 14, and then 15, 16, the bowls of wrath, instead of each one of those sections advancing us chronologically, I believe that rather what we've got here in these sections through most of the book is repetition. But it is repetition from a different viewpoint. What God is doing here is He's saying to the saint who is facing the persecution that these saints were facing, along with all the other problems of life, here are the saints are. What are the questions that the saints have in their minds? A lot of the same questions we have in our minds. What's going to happen? Are we going to win? Can we be sure? Lots of questions like that that are on their minds. So what God is wanting to do is to assure them that, yeah, I know who you are. I know where you are. And if you are my child, you are taken care of. I'm not going to lose you. And you're not going to be lost. And you're going to be all right. Whether you're dead or whether you're alive. And he says, now, what I want to show you is here is my son who comes to earth, the crowning event of all history. And it's like God is telling us this in the book of Revelation. And so I want to show you different viewpoints. I look at these things in different ways. I want to show you different aspects of what I'm doing. I want to show you different aspects of time itself and of the things that happen, the things you have to deal with. And to you, they're just problems. But I have purposes beyond what you realize. And so a lot of what he does in here is to show us these forces, the powers that are at work, as they fit within his plan and as they serve for different purposes. And one of the questions asked, even in the sixth chapter, is how long, O Lord? You know, almost like, Lord, are you just delaying? What do you think? No, the Lord never delays. In other words, 2 Peter says in chapter 3 that God is not slack concerning His promises. Okay? So it's not that God gets busy with other stuff and forgets what He was doing. No, He has purpose. So that's a kind of a view I want us to keep in mind as we study these chapters now. And so as we open the seals, I believe that the seals are just first revealing, now here are the things that you're going to be facing. An assortment. an assortment of problems, an assortment of forces at work. All right, so let's look at what these forces are. And then he's going to show us another vision from another viewpoint. Same forces, same stuff going on, but he's going to show us another view of it. I hope you understand that. I hope you grasp that idea, you know, because it's like God saying you can look at the same set of circumstances and there are a lot of different angles to look at. Now, we all can understand that, can't we? You can look at a circumstance, some things going on here, and you can look at it from different standpoints. So that's what we're going to see going on here. All right, so he takes the scroll. Verse 1, "And I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures saying, as with a voice of thunder, come." Some versions, some old versions say, "come and see." Now, in the first four seals, each one of them is going to be announced by one of the four living creatures. So, the first one is open. "I heard one of the four living creatures saying, as with a voice of thunder," that'd be a loud, booming voice, "come." And so, John comes, and he observes, "And I saw, and behold, a white horse. And he that sat thereon had a bow. And there was given unto him a crown, and he came forth conquering and to conquer." Now that doesn't tell us who it was. We have just been told what John saw. And so it's up to us then to conclude, if we can conclude, who this is. Now in chapter 19, we read about a white horse again, and the one that sits on the horse and everything like that. Who do you think the white horse is? The one riding the white horse. I believe this is Jesus. I don't have any question about that. I think this is Jesus. The white horse, he comes conquering and to conquer, has the crown. Here is one who has been given all authority, all power. He's been given a kingdom, remember? Kingdom, authority, all that. He comes forth conquering and to conquer. Has a bow, and I don't know any particular thing to say except that that was one of the weapons that was used to make war. So here he comes conquering and to conquer. And do remember constantly, I hope you will go back to the points that were made in the Old Testament as God through His prophets was speaking of this one who was going to come and what He was going to do, that He was going to bring everything in subjection. In other words, God has put all things in subjection under His feet. That is, in theory and in authority. But Jesus is in the process of accomplishing that. Remember? So you see that? Like Philippians 3, verses 20 and 21. Verse 21 particularly, that He has power whereby He is able to subject all things unto Himself. Obviously, not everything is brought into that subjection yet, because what is the last enemy that shall be conquered? And has it been conquered yet? No, it hasn't been conquered yet, because when it is conquered, when the last enemy is conquered, what does 1 Corinthians 15 say, then will be? Then cometh the end. So, obviously, Jesus is in the position of making war, of conquering, and he's in the process of bringing everything in subjection under His feet. An important part of that is the people who are converted and bow the knee voluntarily. Who, out of love and reverence, bow the knee and confess His name. So there's a process of subjection going on there, and I think that that is the point that's being made here. So here is Christ going forth to do His work, conquering and to conquer. So that's one of the big historical factors going on here. It overshadows everything else. Now, I used to try to make everything else occur because the one on the white horse went forth. And although, as I've said, the one on the white horse going forth, the work of Jesus, overshadows everything, I'm not sure that we're supposed to look for some kind of a sequence here. I rather think that what we're looking at here is just a presentation of various forces and various influences, various things that the person living on earth is going to have to deal with. The Christian's going to have to deal with them. The person on earth is going to have to deal with them. But do you see a difference between the way a person of the earth who is not a Christian might deal with certain of these things and the way a Christian would deal with them? What about that? Haven't we often made the point when we have lost some loved one and we're comforting ourselves in the Lord and we're comforting ourselves with that hope in Christ and we say, I don't know how someone can stand this if they don't have Christ. Right? So obviously, there is a difference between the way Christians deal with these things and the way people of the world deal with them. And as we look at some of these later sections, I think that what we're going to be looking at is the way the world deals with these things, and God being aware of the way the world is going to look at these things and the way the world deals with these things. But right now, we're looking at it from the standpoint, I believe, more of how the Christian is going to deal with these things. So here Christ goes forth conquering and to conquer. His work is in progress. And if I'm a Christian, if you're a Christian, it is because of this work that is going on. Now he opens the second seal. I heard the second living creature say, come. And another horse came forth, a red horse. Now you can look back in Zechariah and the horses that are mentioned back in Zechariah, but I don't really find, I don't find any correspondence that I feel very comfortable about making. The sequence is not the same. It doesn't seem to fit to me. And when Zechariah talks about what these things are, when he asks about what they are, it doesn't seem to fit. So I don't think we're going to get any help from Zechariah on these things here. So all we can do is say, okay, here's a horse, comes forth, a red horse. And to him that sat thereon, it was given to take peace from the earth, and that they should slay one another. And there was given unto him a great sword. Now this sword, this great sword, is a great battle sword. And I looked up the word just to be sure that they should slay one another. And the word slay there does not mean persecute. In other words, its definition is not persecute. I believe, therefore, it is more than likely that the red horse and the one that sits upon the red horse is representing the force of war, terrorism, turmoil that causes death. Now see, isn't that a force that people have to deal with? You think about today, in a more limited sense, we've had two Middle Eastern campaigns. Before that, we had the Vietnamese War. Before that, we had the Korean War. Before that, we had the Second World War. Before that, we had the First World War. That's just in the last century. And into this one. Christians have to deal with these forces in one sense or another. They'll be involved one way or the other. It's a force that's there. And it has to be dealt with. And the innocent die too. And so the fact that it says that who is this? Could it be the devil sitting on the red horse? Well, I have no doubt that the devil is behind the violence and the wickedness and the murdering and the turmoil. I have no doubt that he's behind it, but I am not sure that I would say, you know, you have to be careful that you say, oh, well, it's got to be the devil because the horse is red. Oh, the devil is red. Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. See, you have to be careful about that. So I can't assume that because the horse is red that the devil's the one sitting on him. I really don't know. And I don't think it's that important for me to know who's sitting on this horse, because the thing that's being emphasized is this is a force that Christians must deal with. And so what he's doing now is just he's painting a picture for us of these forces. Look at the next one. Let's go ahead and look at a few of these seals and kind of get through the fourth seal. And then we'll kind of have a little picture beginning to take shape here. And when he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature saying, "Come." And I remind you, it is very obvious, isn't it? Very plain that we've got the four living creatures introducing the first four seals. Now, in the structure, keeping the structure of the book in mind, that helps. You know, you've got a very discernible pattern there, and you can remember that. And so come, and I saw, and behold, a black horse. And he that sat thereon had a balance in his hand. And I heard, as it were, a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, "A measure of wheat for a shilling, and three measures of barley for a shilling, and the oil and the wine hurt thou not." When you see the grim reaper portrayed on television or in a cartoon, what color is the grim reaper? Black. But I don't think this is meant to be the grim reaper. There again, see, that's that stuff that we've made up. So to find the identity, or whatever this force is, has a balance in his hand. Now, could that mean he's justice? You know, because sometimes don't you see justice symbolized by a woman with a balance in her hand? Yeah, but this is not justice here. What else do you use a balance for? Yeah, like if you're going to weigh some little stuff out, you know, like if you're going to buy something, you can't buy much of it, then you get a little bit of it and it's weighed out on a balance. I think this is economic hardship, famine, economic hardship, possibly also including economic discrimination, possibly against Christians. Now, I don't know about that. That could be involved in it. But one of the things to note is that he says, a measure of wheat. Now, from what I read, and the footnote right here in this Bible, estimates that was about a quart. And the coin in the original is a denarius. And remember that a denarius was the wage for one day's work by just a common laborer. A man who would just go out and work in one of the common jobs of the day, a denarius. So that would mean that you could buy a quart of wheat for a day's wage. Now, you think about what are you going to do with that wheat? That's you've got your wife and four children. And what else are you going to use to pay for your taxes? What else are you going to use to pay for? You kind of see you're facing some hard times here. Well, one thing you could do, you could buy barley. Because barley, you could buy three measures of barley. Barley was not as tasty a grain. It was not as desirable a grain. But still, this is portraying hard times. And yet, the oil and the wine hurt thou not. Now, if it were a matter of famine because of drought, grasshoppers, stuff like that, then one wonders why it wouldn't hurt the grapevines. Why would it not hurt the olive trees? And so that difference that the wheat is being sold, it's rationed. It's being rationed, and the barley is being rationed. The oil and wine, why, they're not being rationed. It sort of sounds like it's a time when the wealth, if you've got enough money, you can have whatever you want. You don't have much money, you are going to just have to get by on the very least you can get by on. Now, I know Tim is sometimes in here. He's not in here now, but I think that I know this is what I learned when I was in Brazil. And I know that the situation has changed a lot. So I don't know how true this is today, but in the years ago when the Fishers were down there along with the Allens and so on, and I went down there, what I found out was that they had kind of like a, they had a tier. They had different tiers of pricing. You could pay just a very nominal amount of money, and you could have your basic power that you use for lights. And you might even get by using enough power to have one of these little heaters they fix down there that attach to the shower head and would produce the water right there, more or less, sometimes with some sparks, but more or less. And you could get by on that. Now, you decide that you're going to have a house full of all kinds of computers and everything else, and you're going to have all kinds of demands on electricity. Then what happens is, as your tier usage goes up, guess what? So does the money. Enormously. So that if you use a lot of electricity, then the government has it structured where you're going to be spending a lot of money. So if you have a lot of money, then you have all the electricity you want. So I rather think that it's somewhat of a situation like that here, you know, poverty, economic hardship, from whatever source it may come from. That's another force we're going to have to deal with. Christians have to deal with those forces, just like people in the world have to deal with those forces. And when he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature saying, "Come." And I saw, and behold, a pale horse. A pale horse. Someone else, in your translation, verse 8, you have a different description than a pale horse. An ashen horse. Anyone else? It's a little difficult to envision exactly what that looks like. But faded? Buford, do you have any idea? Kind of a gray, except, you know, some gray horse is just beautiful. This one's not beautiful, is it? No. Sickly pale, yeah. And his name, the one that sat upon him. Now this is interesting because the first one, even though we know who he was, he's not named. The second one sat on the red horse, he's not named. One that sat on the black horse, not named. One that sits upon the pale horse is named what? Death. His name was Death, and Hades followed with him. Now, don't make too much of this. We might say, oh, was Hades on another horse? I don't know. It doesn't say anything about another horse. I don't know how he followed him, but I know Hades followed him. Well, wherever death goes, why does Hades follow it? Well, because when the dead die, where do they go? They go to Hades. So that's the only reason he has these connected here. All right, now, death. Death. There was given unto them authority over the fourth part of the earth to kill with sword and with famine and with death and by the wild beast of the earth. Now, since it's over the fourth part, then all that means is that at any given time there's going to be dying going on the earth. Here's another force. Now, you know what? As we Christians are upon the earth, death is one of the forces we have to deal with. And it's so frightening, and it can be so disappointing. And many times death has caused the destruction of the faith. I've heard of it just destroying the faith of a Christian. I've heard people say, well, since God let my dad die, I'm not going to believe in God anymore. Something like that. And, you know, I've always thought, like, when my dad died years ago, or when my mother died, if I got mad at God and said, I'm not going to believe in God anymore, does that have anything to do with whether God is or not? But what does it guarantee? That I will be destroyed. And if my faithful mom and daddy were saved, I won't be with them and I won't see them anymore. So I never have been able to figure out what anyone gains by saying, you know, well, I give up. No, I can feel for people that are put to the test. But I want to tell you, you're not going to gain a thing when you just say, I give up. Right. Right. That's right. David prayed his heart out to save that child. And then the child died. David had been told by God it was going to happen. He prayed, trying to get to avert it. It would not be averted. And he said, okay, he can't come to me. I'll go to him. That's right. But now death is one of those things that we deal with. In other words, here we've got forces that are at work in the world that make it difficult. These are things that bring unhappiness. These are things that bring tragedy into our lives. And these are the things that sometimes make us question, are we winning? Can you see how that could sometimes make you feel, am I winning? I don't feel like I'm winning. Revelation is here to say, you are. You are winning. Don't equate whether you feel bad with whether you're winning. Don't equate how much money you may have or may not have with whether you're winning. This winning, this battle is what kind of a battle? It's a spiritual battle. And I think that one of the things that he will do when he gets to chapter 12 is that God is going to say, you think that you are the ones that are really fighting this battle? You think that you're seeing the struggle? I'm going to show you what the struggle really is. And he pulls this curtain back and we see this great big red dragon there standing ready to, kind of a jolting thing to realize that you and I are just bit players. You and I are just bit players in what's going on here. But as we look at ourselves and we focus on our lives and so on, these are things that can trouble us greatly. And in addition to all of these things, these people living at this time were suffering grievous persecution. So one of the things that, you know, I want to try to help everyone to see that this has something for you and me. Because when you and I are facing these things in life, this book has a message for us too. And so I want us to hang on to that and really latch on to that. Now, he opened the fifth seal. Now, the fifth seal, see, is not going to involve a living creature. The fifth seal, when he had opened the fifth seal, I saw underneath the altar the souls of them that had been slain for the word of God. Now, this is the first time that this category has been specifically mentioned. Whether it was included in some of the others or not, maybe it was and just not specified. But this is the first time it's actually specified. These are the souls of them that had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. Clearly, who are these? These are the martyrs. These are the Christian martyrs. And by the way, that word martyr means witness. The word, the English word martyr is a Greek word that's just given English letters. And it means a witness. But the idea is a witness who stuck with his witness, who stuck with his testimony like Stephen did until he died, until he was put to death. And in Acts 22, remember that Paul says to Jesus that when your faithful witness was slain, he was talking about Stephen, you know. That's the word. These are the martyrs. And they cried with a great voice, saying, how long, O Master, the holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? Listen, is it all right for them to ask that question? Is it all right for them to ask that question? If it were not all right, what do you think God would have said to them? That's right. It's okay for them to ask that question. They're not asking the question out of hatred, but there is this thing that one must balance. That whereas when I deal with the wicked, I want the wicked to be saved. I'd like the wicked to learn the truth, be converted, repent. That's the desire that every one of us has for the sinners of all the world. But at the same time, As a Christian, you and I subscribe to the idea that's presented to us in the Bible that there is a God, and that this God is a righteous being, and He is a being of justice. Now, if He is a being of justice, then what does that assure us that He's going to do? At some point, He is going to make right all the wrongs. And it is not wrong for us to enjoy that quality of God. And to feel, because see, if we say, okay, now you're saying, God, that you want me to be just and you want me to be right, you want me to really emphasize that in my life, and then you're not going to do it. No, that wouldn't work. So what they're saying here is not being said out of an idea just of hatred. They're wanting justice done. They know that what was done was not right. And they want right to be done. And so when they ask Him, "How long, O Master, the holy and true, dost Thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth?" And this is so beautiful. He just says, "Here, take this white robe." So, you know, isn't that beautiful? You know, here's this person that's just so concerned and so wrought up over what's happened. And it's God. It's like God just kind of pats him on the head and says, "Here, have a white robe." But that's not all He says. "Here, have a white robe. And it was said unto them that they should rest yet for a little time." You can relax. It's over for you. You can rest. Here's your white robe. You just rest for a while. "Until their fellow servants also and their brethren who should be killed even as they were should have fulfilled their course." So God is saying, there is a time that will come when I will deal with it. But right now, there are others who must meet the same fate you have. And one of the big things that Revelation does is it helps us to understand that if in Jesus you die, you didn't lose. If in Jesus you die from persecution, you didn't lose. We have almost a feeling that if you die, if something happens, like we pray for somebody that is sick and they don't get well, well, they lost. No, they went to heaven. Exactly. And so I believe a lot of what Revelation does is help us to change our attitude and look at life more from the divine standpoint. And that's one thing God is really going to work hard on here in this Revelation. He is wanting us to see all life with all of its forces, with all the things, from a divine standpoint. And I just think it's so beautiful here how He comforts these people. And all He does is just say, "Well, you just rest, and I'll deal with it eventually." In other words, He doesn't say, "Well, let me see, it's 7:35. How about next week? Or how about 5 years from now?" He says, "You let me worry about that. I'll handle that. Right now, you just rest. Take your ease." Can't think of much better than that, can you? That's pretty good. That's not His main concern.
But He does care, so
yes.
We've done a lot more damage than what we're going to be punished.
Right.
We've done the same.
That's right. And sometimes we just have to be careful that our attitude is not out of a personal vengeance, a personal hatred idea. Somebody dared cross me, you know, that kind of thing. Now, there's another thing to bear in mind is that a lot of these Christians of this day were fairly new. And I remember that when the Thessalonians were converted and they had such persecution, just such fire, it was dealt with extensively by Paul in 1 Thessalonians and 2 Thessalonians. One of the fears was that that persecution would frighten them off. And that they would get the idea that because I'm being persecuted, that proves I've made the wrong decision. So can you see why this would be a very important thing to present to them, to help them to understand that no, you haven't made the wrong decision. This is going to come with it. Yes, Harold? Yes, that's right. Right. That's right. That's right. This is given to comfort us. That's what it's given for. It's given to comfort us, Mike.
One of the hard things to understand in studying this today is
exactly. That's right. Is of the That's right. We're scared to death of the first death. That's a good point, Mike. Excellent point. Yes, the goal must be that we not be harmed by the second death. The first death may not be pleasant, but it won't hold a candle compared to what the second death is going to be. That's a good point. I appreciate you making that point.
The Lord's going to take care of them.
That's right.
And they'll not suffer any loss just because of the fact that they're not living anymore.
Yeah.
And so he says, don't you sorrow like the world does.
That's right. Now, what, Bill, what if you were one of those people that you had lost some loved one to some persecution, you know, some cruel persecutor, and you get hold of this and you're reading and you read right there? And there was given to each of them a white robe, and it said, rest for a while. That kind of change your attitude, wouldn't it? They're okay. They're okay. Now, we just can hardly identify with that. But I'm just thinking, you know, if you had lost one that was truly a loved one of yours, and you were just so worried about it, just what became of them? Remember how the Thessalonians were also worried about their dead loved ones? And how Paul had to help them with that and say, they're not going to be lost. They won't be left behind. They won't be forgotten. And you read this right here. Man, how comforting that would be. Chuck, do I see a thought? So how did I know? Go ahead. Right. That's right. Right. That's right. Wasn't something that God was just letting happen for no purpose, no plan. In fact, looking at the translation I do have, the word "their course" is in italics. It's not even in the original. So it's just until they have completed, until they have gotten through. You know, we might say, till they have gotten through. Okay, has the bell rung? Okay. All right, we'll take up with verse.